Welcome. We, as usual, welcome everyone of whatever religious belief, whatever gender, sexual orientation, color of your skin. We are try to be very welcoming, so I hope we are this morning. And our service, we certainly invite you, if this is one of your first times or your first time, to come back, because the services are different from week to week. They are led by, sometimes by people outside our community, sometimes by me, the minister, and often by people, lay leaders within the congregation. And this morning, the president of our board, Barb Park, will lead the service. We'll have a wonderful presentation in a few moments. What you just heard was written by Mary Ashton Rice, a Universalist woman, an abolitionist, a suffragist, and a social reformer who lectured and wrote for religious and reform periodicals and served as president of the American Woman Suffrage Association, the Association for the Advancement of Women, and the Massachusetts Woman's Christian Temperance Union. She was renowned for the clarity, passion, and depth of her oratory. And she lived, she's the one who lived from 1820
right.
to, yeah, 1820 to 1905.
A couple of years ago, I gave a program on the first century plus of Universalism. You may have missed it. It was based on a program given at General Assembly in Vancouver, British Columbia in 1992. I've modified the current the program from the one I gave that, or the one that was given the next year at General Assembly in Charlotte, North Carolina, which covered the second 100 years. When I was working through this, I've left out a lot of hymns and I've changed a lot of readings in order to both shorten it and to personalize it. But I've included a bunch of stories that take a little longer but make it more fun and I think more meaningful. As our opening words, we're going to make a quick review of the history of Universalism from its introduction in America to the Civil War, based on a review done for that second program at Charlotte. And it's going to be read by members of the choir. And we need a mic. Peter? We need Susan has it, okay. We'll just pass it down.
America began discovering Universalism when George de Benville came to Pennsylvania in 1741.
John Murray delighted the ears of Thomas Potter when he preached on the New Jersey shore in 1770. And heeded Potter's demand to share the Universalist gospel that God is love.
God is loving and forgiving, like a caring parent.
Eternal punishment, hellfire, and bitter sectarianism are the real heresies.
God loves all people in every condition, all over the world.
Salvation is universal. All souls will come into harmony with God and know the joys of heaven.
That message was a strong antidote to the orthodoxy of the period and was spread by preachers on horseback to Canada, New Orleans, Oregon, and many a town in between.
Convinced of God's love from searching the scriptures, Universalists preached, published, and debated successfully with popular purveyors of doom.
They applied their universality to all human issues. As early as 1790, Judith Sargent Murray wrote an essay proclaiming the rights of women.
Olympia Brown and a host of her sisters were officially ordained as Universalist ministers.
Universalists reasoned that if we're all going to be in heaven together, we'd better learn how to get along amicably on earth.
Slavery and war were proclaimed as abominations to a loving God.
The way was not easy. Universalism was denounced as an anathema and Universalists as heathens.
the right of free assembly, the right to support one's own chosen church, the right to ordain one's own clergy had to be won by legal battles.
Early preachers and their congregations were often far-flung and lonely.
So they began to meet together and held their first regular assembly in September 1793, the date that we celebrate as the formation of the Universalist denomination.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to light our chalice, and Rick Recking is going to help me by doing that. And the chalice as a UU symbol is relatively recent. Before the chalice was used in Universalist circles, a small group of Universalist ministers who were gathering regularly from 1946 to 1954 adopted as their symbol the off-centered cross enclosed by a circle. The circle represented the all-embracing nature of Universalism, and the off-centered cross recognized Universalism's Christian roots while implying that Christianity was no longer central to the faith. You'll occasionally still see this symbol at UU gatherings. Okay, now we'll have a minute of silent meditation. Okay. Our first hymn is a handout that you have along with your order of service. And I think what drew me to Universalism as a child was its unfailing optimistic view of life. Our first hymn expresses the optimism that Universalists had for the future in the mid-19th century. When I did a program on Universalism's early years, a couple of years ago, we ended with this hymn. The words were written in 1852 by Universalist Frances Dana Gage, who was a champion of the cause of abolition, women's rights, and temperance. She wrote children's books and poems under the pen name Aunt Fanny. In 1850, she petitioned the Ohio State Legislature to remove two words of power and privilege from the state constitution. The words were white and male. So when we sing this, you can judge how far we've progressed since then.
It. And that wasn't the last millennium of which they were speaking either.
Okay, some of you will remember that the UUA is made up of two previous separate groups, the Unitarians and the Universalists. These two groups with similar ideas as to the nature of God and salvation were finally merged into one in 1961. I was raised in the Universalist Church in Syracuse, New York. Rick Recking was raised in a Unity Temple in Oak Park, Illinois, which was also a Universalist church. I think we're the only two kind of born and bred Universalists in the group. Today we're going to talk about the second century of Universalism, starting at the beginning of the Civil War, 100 years before merger. In the mid-century, that's the mid-19th century, a major concern of many Americans was slavery. Universalists preached and prayed, lobbied and marched against slavery, but it took a bloody civil war to end it. Universalist men joined the Union Army in large numbers, and almost 50 ministers became chaplains. A number of Universalist women became nurses, the most famous of whom, of course, was Clara Barton, who became known as the Angel of the Battlefield. In April 1861, she visited soldiers wounded in one of the first battles of the war and began a one-woman relief operation that later culminated in the organization of the American Red Cross. Another activist woman, Universalist woman at the time, was Julia Ward Howe. And I'm talking about some of these things because this is music is pulled through this whole thing. And she was married to Samuel Gridley Howe, who was a famed scholar in the education of the blind. Samuel and Julia were also active leaders in the anti-slavery politics and strong supporters of the Union. Julia was attending a review of the soldiers of the troops outside of Washington, D.C. as they went marching by and heard them singing John Brown's Body. You remember that, John Brown's Body, lays a molding in the grave, yes. And she was not, the marching song, and the person who was with her, who was a Universalist minister, James Freeman Clark, said, "Julia, you should write new words to that," because they weren't too impressed with the words. So she did. She woke up in the middle of the night, a couple nights later, and the words to the Battle Hymn of the Republic came to her mind, and she woke up, she stood up in the middle of the night, sat down and wrote them down. So the words were first published in the front page of the Atlantic Monthly in February 1862. Who knew the Atlantic Monthly was being published then? And it became the marching song of the war, with her words, not the other words. And it's, you know, really the signature song that you think of for the Civil War. But since the Battle Hymn of the Republic is so familiar to all of you, we won't take the time to sing it today. But these Universalist women were organizers, and they were organizing. They voted in Universalist churches long before the Unitarian Fathers thought it would be safe to extend such a franchise to Unitarian women. In 1869, the Universalist Women's Centenary Aid Association was formed to celebrate John Murray's arrival in America and to aid needy ministers and struggling churches. It gained members, raised money, and furthered the Universalist cause. In a single year, 13,000 Universalist women joined this first American denominational women's organization. It was soon clear to them, if not for the men, that Universalist women were organized for good and would no longer quietly take orders from the men. From Universalism's early days, there were women who wrote, published, organized, and preached. But it was during the second half of the century that Universalists became the first denomination to accept the ordination of women. Lydia Jenkins, the wife of a Universalist clergyman in Port Byron, New York, started preaching in 1850. And she continued in what we'd now call a co-ministry. Both she and her husband spoke. She was probably never ordained, but many prominent women are men clearly objected to this arrangement. However, Olympia Brown was ordained with full denominational authority in 1863, and other women soon followed. Olympia Brown and Phoebe Hannaford, another early minister, became leaders in suffrage and equal rights. Caroline Sewell became the Universalist's first missionary to Scotland. Florence Crocker created an innovative ministry for youth and was a popular missionary for the needful heathen in California. By the time the 19th Amendment was passed in 1920, a total of 88 women had been ordained as Universalist ministers. With the exception of the Unitarians, who had ordained 42 women by that point, other denominations were slow to follow suit, and it was another half a century before the ordination of women became common in American church life. Then after the Civil War, there was a great Protestant revival movement with hearty preaching and gospel singing. It drew some Universalist attention, not for the theology, which Universalists flatly rejected, but for the spirit of the message and for those singable, sentimental songs. So here's a story of the most famous Universalist gospel. There was a man called J.P. Webster, who was a musician, wrote music, but subject to periods of deep depression. He went to visit his friend, Sanford Bennett, at his pharmacy. Bennett was a pharmacist in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. And Webster said, or Bennett said, "Webster, what's the matter now?" "It's no matter," he replied. "It will be all right by and by." And the idea of a hymn came like a flash of sunlight, Bennett says. And he sat down and wrote the words to "The Sweet By and By." He showed them to his friend, and it immediately kind of revived his friend. And so he then turned around. He had his violin, and he turned around and he penned the note to the chorus of "Sweet By and By." And within a half an hour, they and two other people were standing there singing to "The Sweet By and By." And but everybody's still surprised to learn that this is a universalist hymn, because it became very popular and is used very widespread. I bet everybody here knows this. And the choir's going to sing it for you now. If you caught the words of that, you can understand why it's a universalist gospel song. Very positive. Self-educated universalist pioneers came to value formal education. Even in the public schools of the day, their children were being bombarded with Calvinist teachings and labeled as heathens. Universalists started more than 20 non-sectarian schools. Higher public education was also tainted with denominational evangelizing. To counter this, universalists started five colleges by 1872, including two which prepared candidates for the Universalist ministry: St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York, and Tufts College in Medford, Massachusetts. None other than P.T. Barnum, showman of the circuses and prima donnas, was a great supporter of Tufts and served on its board and contributed generously. A man of diverse interests, Barnum was an articulate and passionate spokesperson for universalism. His pamphlet, "Why I Am a Universalist," won approval from the universalist leaders, but they balked when he proposed to hang a sign saying, "I'm a universalist," on his prized elephant, Jumbo. In fact, when Jumbo died after being struck by a train outside of London, Ontario, Barnum gave his handsomely stuffed skin to Tufts University, where it was the showpiece of Barnum Hall. Alas, Jumbo was accidentally incinerated when the building burned down. But Jumbo rose again. There's a replica of the stuffed Jumbo on display at the Barnum Museum in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And Jumbo's humongous skeleton is on view at the Natural History Museum in New York. And there's also a statue of Jumbo kind of at the point of his demise outside of London, Ontario. But be it noted, there are no signs identifying Jumbo's religious persuasion from him. Okay, by the 1880s, Universalists had become more organized and more conservative. In 1803, they had developed what would be called a statement of faith that became known as the Winchester Profession. And one of the key provisions of that was dubbed the Liberty Clause, which essentially said, yeah, this is what you say, but you can really believe anything you want. This was scrapped in 1870, and the profession began to be used almost as a creed. Needless to say, there were a lot of universalists who were pretty incensed by this. And at that time, there's a story that illustrates that new rigidity. there was a man named Herman Bisbee who was the minister of the St. Paul Universalist Church in Minnesota. And he made a little trip to Boston and came back and started preaching Emersonian natural religion. He said that religion is, quote, the effect which man makes to perfect himself, the effort which man makes to perfect himself, not the effort God makes to perfect him, unquote. This caused a great scandal in the Universalist press, and the church fathers eventually kicked Bisbee out of it. Although his church supported him, in the end, he moved over and became a Unitarian minister. Before and after World War, I'm skipping because I'm running out of time, so already. Before and after World War I, social issues took the front stage. The driving intellect of this movement was Clarence Skinner, a pacifist who became the dean of Tufts University's Crane Theological School. In 1917, he offered a Declaration of Social Principles, which was adopted by the denomination as the basis of social witness. By this time, the Liberty Clause had been reinstated with new language. And in this Principles for Social Witness, the preamble says, quote, through all the agencies of the church, we shall endeavor to educate and inspire the community and the nation to a keener social consciousness and a truer vision of the kingdom of God on earth. Okay, truth be told, Universalism was beginning to decline after World War I. There were probably three factors at work. Universalism was by predominantly a rural based religion and or denomination, and people after World War I were beginning to migrate to the cities, so leaving sometimes too few people in the pulpit to have the church continue. So lots of, as you even travel around Wisconsin and watch, you'll see lots of churches that are labeled Universalist that have long since closed. The buildings are there, but no more are they churches. Because of this migration. There were two other causes. One was the Universalists were never very good at organizing. They had a fundamental distrust of centralized power. And so consequently, they didn't do a good job of organizing and getting their message out. And also, their message was being taken up by others, leaving the basic question, if they were still a unique and relevant doctrine, or should they be moving beyond the outer limits of Christianity? Because much of they had been almost too successful for their own good. Lots of their doctrine had moved into other denominational churches. In 1935, they accepted a new bond of fellowship and a statement of faith, generally known as the Washington Avowal. And I bet you, Rick, you read this when you were a kid. I sure did. It says, the bond of fellowship in the church shall be a common purpose to do the will of God as Jesus revealed it, and to cooperate in establishing the kingdom for which he lived and died. To that end, we avow our faith in God as eternal and all-conquering love, in the spiritual leadership of Jesus, in the supreme worth of every human personality, and in the authority of truth known or to be known, and the power of men of goodwill and sacrificial spirit to overcome all evil and progressively establish the kingdom of God. We read that every Sunday in church. While the Universalists were working on this new statement, there was another one being written, and that's the Humanist Manifesto, which claimed that a distinction could no longer be made between the sacred and the secular, that the universe was self-existing rather than created, that traditional religion was no longer relevant, that was signed by Clinton Scott, who was the minister, the Universalist minister of the Peoria Church in Peoria, Illinois, and there were two other signers who were Unitarian ministers who also had a kind of a co-fellowship with Universalists. And unlike Bisbee earlier, when his, was kind of kicked out for his radical views, Scott continued to be popular and accepted as a minister among the Universalists, and actually was elected to a prominent office. By 1943, Robert Cummins addressed the General Assembly saying, "Universalism cannot be limited to either Protestantism or to Christianity, not without denying its very name. Ours is a world fellowship, not just a Christian sect. For so long as universalism is universalism and not partialism, the fellowship bearing its name must succeed in its unmistakably clear that all are welcome, theist and humanist, Unitarian and Trinitarian, colored and colorless. A circumscribed universalism is unthinkable." Okay, so following World War II, the Universalists took two different trajectories. One was a Christian wing led by, or at least what to us was Christian. It certainly wouldn't be recognized as Christian by fundamentalist Christians. But a Christian wing led by, among others, Ellsworth Riemann of Syracuse, who was, of course, my minister. The other was a liberal wing that espoused a universalized universalism that moved beyond Christianity toward a universal religion and world community. To fashion worship for such a faith, the Reverend Kenneth Patton was called to conduct an experiment in worship at the Charles Street Meeting House in Boston. Interestingly enough, he was called from First Society here in Madison. Patton became an energetic and articulate advocate of world universalism. He wrote, "The Meeting House has one basic and simple idea, to find a religious setting for a religion of humanity and one world." Patton's marvelous talents and energy and those of the congregation joined to create the symbols, religious festivals, new hymns, and reading. And they were published, he published them in the Meeting House Press and shared them widely. And if you go through our hymn book, there are tons of hymns and readings that hold Patton's name. Okay, then in 1955, a merger commission was formed. Their recommendations said that the Unitarians and Universalists hold enough in common to become one people. There were many Universalists who initially opposed this, fearing that what they valued in Universalism would be lost, or that they would simply be swallowed up by the Unitarians. On the other hand, some Unitarians felt that the Universalists were simply too conservative to fit. However, merger moved along. Two parallel conventions were held in Syracuse, New York in 1959. And after much heated wrangling over language and structure, the merger was passed. Paul Carnes, who later became president of the UUA, remarked that at that assembly, quote, "something happened to the Universalists. They met the Unitarians and found that Unitarians are, more or less, just like Universalists, except that there are more of them and they make more noise." So merger was finalized in 1961. Okay, you can see if you were paying attention that I grew up in a church ministered by the champion of the Christian wing. And I adored my minister, Dr. Riemann. I mean, he was one of the reasons that I kept going from the time when a friend took me to church when I was about four, and then when they moved away, I said, "Mother, I'm not stopping going to church." So she had to go, and she said, "What was I going to do, sit in the parking lot?" So she came in and discovered that that was the church she had been looking for. So of course, when we voted, I voted a Ginnett. Dr. Riemann was one of those that was worried that that Universalists would be simply swallowed up by the more populist Unitarians. I was worried that we would lose some of this character, this kind of world religion character that was really developing. But probably it was a good thing that we went through with merger. And even then, in his church, I still had atheist and humanist leanings. I just didn't talk about them. But the turning point for me in terms of this concept of world religion was when I went to camp at Unirondack, which is a Universalist camp in the Adirondack Mountains in New York. And we sang this hymn that we're about to sing. And it made me what I would call a one-worlder. And it's a hymn that we sing often here. And so after we sing this, then we'll have time for discussion. 318. You can see how that would influence a teenager.
Yeah.
Now we have, amazingly, some time for discussion. I cut many pages out of the talk. There are some churches, I think the one in Peoria, that is a Universalist Unitarian church. And Wausau, Wisconsin, is the Universalist Unitarian church. For our closing words, these were the words spoken by 2,000 delegates at the joint 1961 assembly to pledge their allegiance to their newly formed denomination. We Unitarians and Universalists, children of the Judeo-Christian heritage, inheritors of the wisdom of the universal prophets, eager to experience the insights of the great face of the world, open to all sources of inspiration, ancient and modern, determined to explore the boundless ocean of truth which lies about on every hand and on before, and welcoming into fellowship all men of whatever background of faith, here together on this night of consolidation, conscious of the presence of the past and of our urgent task, dedicating ourselves anew to the free and universal fellowship of all mankind that is the church to be. Okay, go in peace, greet your neighbors, and stay for coffee.